This is Speaking Freely. I'm Annette Newell. So glad you chose to listen in. With ballots in households and in their hands, Oregon's voters are making their decisions about who they'll choose to lead their state and community and who will represent them in Congress in the coming years. So what are the major voter motivators? That's what we're looking at in this episode, starting with a hotly contested governor's race. Three women, each eager to orate her Oregon origin story.
I am a lifelong Oregonian. I'm a small town girl. I'm originally from Klamath Falls.
I had worked at Oregon Food Bank and Children First for Oregon. My job was to go to the legislature and talk about what people needed.
I grew up in Central Oregon. My father was in the timber business, and both my parents were heavily involved in issues of state-level interest.
It's never happened before, not in Oregon, or even in the whole country. Three well-qualified women running to be the state's next governor. All three have won previous elections. Independent candidate Betsy Johnson
was elected three times to the Oregon House of Representatives. 10 days into my third term, the senator was appointed to a remunerative position. 23 county commissioners unanimously selected me to fill out her term. And then since 2005, I earned election.
Democratic candidate Tina Kotek
served 15 years in the Oregon House representing North and Northeast Portland. 9 years of that service was as the Speaker of the Oregon House. And for that job, I really believe I was serving the entire state. My job as Speaker was to make sure every House member, no matter where they live in the state, no matter who they represented, would be successful.
Republican candidate Christine Drazen.
I was able to work for Republicans who had majority control in the House and the Senate. You know, I was there about 8 years, but half of that time I was Chief of Staff to the House Majority Leader and then the Speaker of the House. I wanted to fight the fight on behalf of my community and work for my own constituents and my own part of the state, and made the decision to run for office. 9 months after being sworn in, I was elected House Republican leader.
So I asked each of them to take an in-depth look at a critical issue to the voters, the housing crisis and homelessness. Homelessness, houselessness, housing insecurity, what needs to be done that has not already been done? I know that you and the other lawmakers have been working on this crisis for a long time, but what else needs to be done to come up with some solutions here? Because the way people see it is we still go outside and we see our neighbors living on the streets still.
Yeah, I see it in my neighborhood in North Portland. It's not acceptable. It's a humanitarian crisis. I think we all agree on that, that that's not how people should be living. And I've been working hard as House leader in the legislature to do something, but it's not been enough. For example, one of the things I worked on was something called Project Turnkey. Over the last 2 years, we've been working hard at the state to convert motels and hotel properties into transitional shelters. Because when someone's in a tent, if you can get them into four walls and a locked door so they can feel more stable, that's when you can have better conversations about helping them get what they need and also get them into permanent housing. Project Turnkey ended up doing 19 new shelters in 13 counties. And only in 7 months, we increased shelter capacity by 20%. So those are the kind of things we need to do more of.
That was Democratic candidate Tina Kotek. Next, I asked Republican Christine Drazen, homelessness and housing insecurity. We have seen so many different approaches tried and frankly failed on these issues over and over again. What do you propose to do differently?
A lot of what we have done recently should change our mindset about this problem. Just the state of Oregon has spent about $1.7 billion on a huge range of programs, funding for landlords or rent assistance or building tiny homes or Project Turnkey that transitioned underutilized motels into spaces for homeless populations. This is not just a simple housing first problem, but homelessness is really, it's a crisis of an individual. It's a human problem. There's a program that's been adopted in particular in Clackamas County and I believe Gresham, but it's called Built for Zero. The concept is one that identifies not a point in time count of homeless populations, which gets you, I think last time it was around 14,000 people statewide, but it gives you a real-time understanding of who is without housing and living on the streets in your region. You begin to treat it more like case management rather than an anonymous, faceless row of tents.
And I asked independent Betsy Johnson,
When it comes to homelessness, what else needs to be done? That seems to be the issue that comes up again and again with Oregonians, as that's their most critical problem.
Well, because it's so obvious. Just go out on any street and you're going to see the tent. I think we've been doing an absolutely crappy job. We haven't used the power of law enforcement. There has been no sense of urgency about getting people off the streets. The Office of Homeless Services has purchased 6,000 tents and God knows how many tarps that now we're scraping off the street. The waste in that is just incalculable. We have not had a sense of urgency. On the day after the election, when I'm the governor, I'm going to convene the requisite people to talk about how do we instill a sense of urgency.
Betsy Johnson, Tina Kotek, and Christine Drazen are competing in a closely watched, tightly polled race for Oregon governor. Major voter motivators this election cycle include homelessness. This week, we saw hundreds of people testifying to Portland City Council about the impact it's had.
I can't tell you the number of stories I've heard from Portlanders who don't feel safe in our city, from children and families who want safe access to our parks and rivers, to elders who want to stroll down the waterfront or simply walk to their local grocery store.
Our rising home prices and housing shortage is, again, not a new issue. Council declared an emergency on this in 2015. Since then, housing prices have continued to rise, which is increasing the number of households that are at risk of homelessness and fueling gentrification and displacement throughout the city. We know we need homes, more homes of all types.
We're lacking in the state of Oregon over 40,000 behavioral and mental health providers. We're lacking culturally specific service providers.
We stood in front of an overflowing crowd and heard from scores of angry, frightened neighbors who were concerned about the impact a shelter would have. I knew that in order to successfully site a shelter in this neighborhood, and in any neighborhood, we need better partnership with our community.
I'm checking everything with my cane, and next thing I'm stepping in feces or somebody's face.
I've never really had a problem with people camping on the sidewalks in the past, but in the last 2 years, those tents took up the entire sidewalk.
We have an encampment that's been there 12 years on a corner. They're swept, they come back.
Sidewalk camping is simply not sustainable. Tents on sidewalks is not a sustainable solution to a horrible problem.
I know you have the will and the resources to point Portland in the right direction. I urge you to do that in an expeditious manner to protect all of us and give us hope.
Portland Mayor Ted Wheeler and his staff presented their plan, which includes ideas like a ban on street camping and designated areas where people experiencing houselessness can stay, along with support services like drug treatment and job placement, as well as a big push for more affordable housing. It's a plan that would require a lot of cooperation from county and state governments as well, and he asked for lots of public input.
Those Portlanders who are unhoused and living on the streets, they deserve our understanding, our compassion, and our help. Our goal should be to connect people with whatever services they need to be able to get off and stay off the streets. We developed these proposals based on input we received from the homeless community and conveyed through our city outreach workers. You might remember, with the lifting of the pandemic restrictions, I declared an emergency that stepped up homeless campsite removals that were problematic, particularly since we had not been doing any campsite removals during the pandemic. This resulted in self-site and unsanctioned encampment removals increasing by 2,844% just between September 2020 and September 2022, nearly 3,000%. As part of this emergency declaration, we improved our offer of shelter space by introducing real-time reservations, transportation to the shelter of choice with personal belongings, and 3 30-day storage of other items. But only about 20% who were offered accepted this new and improved offer of a bed in the local indoor shelter system. In fact, on most nights, there is excess capacity in our indoor shelter system. According to our hardworking city outreach workers, of the hundreds of homeless individuals that they spoke to, the majority said they would not go to an indoor shelter, but would instead like to go to a place where they could pitch their tent, where they would not be asked to move all the time, and many expressed an interest in having access to hygiene, bathroom facilities. For many, designated outdoor camping with services would be seen as a significant improvement over their current conditions. This is one of the many reasons that we're pursuing this approach.
And that was Portland Mayor Ted Wheeler talking about his new plan to focus on solving houselessness. Hour after hour went by with speakers. Some expressed support, others objected. Kaya Sand did both. She's the executive director of Street Roots, a newspaper in Portland focusing on houselessness and poverty.
Upstairs in our Old Town office, many, many people have gathered, many who are experiencing street homelessness. They're watching this hearing on a big sheet. And that's because, quite frankly, that you hold power over their lives. And I'm downstairs. This is our newspaper archive, and we serve as a public memory. I'm holding, actually, newspapers from 25 years ago when we were the Burnside Cadillac, covering camping bans. And I can tell you again and again and again, camping bans come up as something politicians brandish to placate some constituents while making life unbearable for others. And this repeats itself. And I'm happy to give you 25 years of history, but we'll do that in next issue of that legal history of camping bans, mayors, and Portland. But in the meantime, I'm really happy to see that you've sketched out these ambitious goals for affordable housing, for addressing legal entanglements, for low barrier work. This is all very hopeful. And although lacking development, I think agenda items 893 sketch out a horizon in which we can set our gaze as a community and show an intention to work with the other jurisdictions and the hard work they've been doing. So thank you. Unfortunately, like a poison pill, Agenda item 901 does slip in that camping ban. And I need to pull back the veil on something you said in the beginning, Mayor Wheeler. I know you've been talking about outreach. The only evidence we've found is two outreach workers with the impact reduction team. And I need to really emphasize, for the last 24 hours, Afro Village Portland, Blanchet House, Grand Score Association, Join, Impact Northwest, Northwest Pilot Project, Our Just Future, Outside In, Pear, Rose Haven, Sisters of the Road, Street Roots, Urban League, Street Books, on and on. We have been hustling. We have no evidence of outreach. And so we have been fighting to make sure that happens. We thank you, Mayor Wheeler. We thank you, Commissioner Ryan, for accepting an invitation to have a town hall next week with unhoused people. But I need to make sure that you do understand that part of your work is the extended engagement with the people on whose lives your policy impacts.
And that was Kaya Sand, Executive Director of Street Roots, a Portland newspaper that focuses on the homeless community. Portland City Council scheduled more testimony and votes on the new homelessness plan for the coming week. Meantime, candidates are stressing it in their messaging, and voters are voting. For more insight about that, I talked to Dr. Chris Nichols, a historian and scholar at Ohio State University, who has written and edited several books about American history, policy, and politics. So obviously they're trying to motivate the voters right now. So I was going to do this show about voter motivation, what really motivates them, and was hoping to talk to you about that. The big thing that they seem to be trying to motivate our voters in Oregon right now is homelessness. What can you tell us about that as a strategy to focus on homelessness and the feeling of being unsafe that's linked to that? Why is that such a powerful motivator, or is it historically?
Well, I think crime and safety are major motivators historically and in the present. And we've seen a lot of politicization of crime and safety questions really in the pandemic through the present. The big uptick in crime in 2020, directly related to the pandemic, has left the impression for a lot of Americans that they're less safe now, and that, in fact, that has continued, whereas most of the trends suggest that that has not continued with that high level uptick and that of crime, particularly violent crime, and that actually a lot of urban areas are less riven by violent crime than your typical voter thinks. right? And so one example of this is when voters are asked the question or polled or surveyed about where is crime bad, they say things like New York City or Chicago. And the reality is per capita violent crime in New York City or Chicago is much lower, even though Chicago has very high homicide rate, is much lower than low population density areas all around the country. I mean, there's lots and lots of examples of this. So it's a question of a winning kind of issue and motivator that in fact is somewhat divorced from the reality of the trends in our everyday lives. Mm-hmm. Now, the related question of homelessness, though, is one that people see. And so, you know, particularly in the Pacific Northwest, you find, you know, homelessness being very visible because of open public camping, because of the ways in which it can take over, you know, blocks or areas that people pass by, even if it's not very close to their own home. And so that's another way in which this kind of motivator through the optics of seeing homelessness, and most of us are very empathetic and certainly want to help those people who lack homes or for other reasons are underhoused and perhaps not as safe because of that, that may be also somewhat divorced from the realities of the total numbers of people who are homeless or the realities of the situations in particular places. So just adding the two together, crime and homelessness are motivational factors for voters, clearly, but the ways in which they're operationalized by politicians often can be seen as distinct from the actual trends in those behaviors and patterns in American public life.
This is from the Washington Post, an editorial yesterday. The GOP looks to gain an edge in Oregon with public safety top of mind. Concerns about crime and the fallout from the 2020 protests in Portland have become the focus of the gubernatorial race. So Portland has seen a rise in violent crime. And it seems like everybody is going, you know, pointing at each other, saying that you're to blame for this. But considering this is kind of a once in a generation, probably a century pandemic time that kind of shut everything down and contributed to all of this, is it really fair to blame one political party or the other in this scenario?
Yeah, I think your question embodies the answer, right? Which is that, no, it isn't fair to blame the party in power or the individuals who are in power, or at least not fully. You know, it's a little bit like our current moment with inflation. If you look at the ways that voters are generally dissatisfied with what the Biden administration has done, that suggests that people think the Biden administration could have done a lot better. But if you look around the world today, inflation is a global problem. The U.S. has a lower inflation rate than Great Britain, Germany, Mexico. You know, it's a global problem that no one's able to solve right now, regardless of their party or their or how empowered they are. And I think the back around thinking about, you know, Portland became a national kind of litmus test for crime and pandemic policies. And Donald Trump, as everybody will recall, probably made, you know, Portland the epitome in his political rhetoric of a kind of blue city that was defunding the police, as he would have put it, and it was full of anarchists and was on fire, I think was something that he said several times or something along those lines. And so, and that has continued to this current moment, that the kinds of politicization of the city of Portland is a national kind of question or issue. And then the question about that would be, you know, what blame does Mayor Wheeler get in that? What could governors have done or not done in terms of the Black Lives Matter protests, in terms of homelessness? And also, I think equating them is a problem here too, that the protests in and of themselves aren't the problem with downtown Portland, right? And they're not ongoing at present. Many peaceful protests can happen and don't result in property damage. But when they're overlaid with a pandemic and a trend of businesses moving out of downtown areas in general, you have a sort of perfect storm recipe for problems that other cities have also seen. It's not just Portland's concern, but the kind of optics on a national level have made it Portland the kind of figurehead for those broader issues.
Another issue voters are citing as a motivator in this election is abortion and reproductive health care in the wake of the U.S. Supreme Court striking down Roe v. Wade. This week, Democratic candidate for governor Tina Kotek held a press conference with abortion rights supporters about that.
One of the things that I'm hearing from working parents and families around the state is the importance of reproductive health care for the economic freedom that comes along with being able to make that decision for your family. I think we sometimes forget that the issue of abortion is so integral to a family's decision of whether to grow their family and when they start a family. And there are financial implications when people don't have access to health care. And abortion is health care. And when we restrict the ability to get the health care families need, it affects them long term. Christine Drazen's campaign is part of the National Republican agenda to restrict abortion. She has been on camera talking about that clearly. And for the other opponent in the race, Betsy Johnson, there are many reasons why Planned Parenthood has not endorsed her. I'm the only candidate in this race endorsed by Planned Parenthood PAC of Oregon, Pro-Choice Oregon, and the Mother PAC and Oregon Nurses Association, trusted organizations that say the issue of reproductive health care is front and center in this governor's race.
Independent candidate Betsy Johnson says she is firmly pro-choice on this issue, and I talked to Republican candidate Christine Drazen for her thoughts.
The U.S. Senate voted down what was called the Women's Health Protection Act, which would have basically guaranteed the federal right to abortion. What is your position on that?
I am a pro-life woman. I always have been. That's my value set. I've never shied away from that as my position on that issue. I have three kids. That's where I have landed as a person in this world. And I'm also a person of faith, and it's a part of how I see the world. Also, as a candidate in this race, I'm endorsed by Oregon Right to Life. And if I have the opportunity to serve as governor, I would veto legislation that expanded any abortion-related activities in the state. I've always been clear on this issue. Oregon has unlimited access to abortion, and Oregon pays for abortions with public dollars. People in Oregon can have an abortion up to the time that it's time to deliver the baby. There are no restrictions here. If there was a movement to try to expand on that, I would veto that.
What would you do about Oregon's current protections for the right to a legal abortion that's in our state statute?
Well, the Oregon governor is not the Oregon legislature. As I mentioned, everything about access to abortion right now is in Oregon law.
So you wouldn't necessarily want to drive a movement to overturn that?
If the legislature brings something to my desk, I will sign it. It is incredibly unlikely.
Republican candidate for governor Christine Drazen. So I asked Dr. Nichols if abortion is a strong voter motivator.
I haven't talked to you yet about the issue of abortion and how that might be a motivator in this election cycle. Based on what you've seen so far, do you think that is going to be a key motivator?
I think absolutely it is. If you look at polling, a lot of different state level polling, the sort of two issues that are animating Democrats in particular are threats to democracy and abortion. And in my mind, I think that they're linked. I think that your average Democratic voter, when they think about the Dobbs decision, they think that it's a representation of a Supreme Court that's gone too far. It's sort of federal overreach. It's depriving them of a right that they've had all of their lives or most of their lives, depending on their age. And so sort of threat to democracy and abortion or women's reproductive rights more generally are blended. And if you add the two together, you find that they outweigh all the pocketbook politics, right? So that we know that this is a moment where voters are motivated by inflation, gas prices, and other things. And even if you want to talk about the fact that gas prices are down or that inflation is a little less than it was before or that it's a global phenomenon, regardless of that, it is pinching people at the pump, at the grocery counter, and there's no doubt about that. But Democratic voters are just as animated by threats to democracy and abortion. And the other element of this, which we've talked about, is that there were record numbers of women, particularly turning out to register to vote right after the Dobbs decision. In a lot of states, we've seen slight upticks in early voting and absentee ballot requests or absentee ballots coming in. And that's generally skews Democratic now. It used to skew just a little bit Democratic. But now after the Trump administration and his kind of casting aspersions on early voting and absentee and mail voting, Republicans tend to vote, you know, at the very end of the process or on election day in the places that have election days, all of which is to say it looks like, at least in a modest amount right now, so we're not sure, those people are showing up and they are voting on the issues related to threats to democracy and abortion in a way that is not necessarily characteristic of midterm elections where there's depressed turnout and where the party in power almost always loses seats.
Mm-hmm. We're seeing kind of the opposite. with our ballot return rate so far here in Oregon, which is interesting. Like the last time I checked was 2 days ago, so this might be a little old information, but it was like 5% of the total voters who'd been mailed ballots had returned those ballots. At this stage in 2018, it was 8%. So it's a little slower. There are more Democrats returning ballots than Republicans, but that's simply because there's more registered Democrats. Yeah. Right. So it is interesting. It's pretty even percentage-wise. Mm. It was like 2.7% of Democrats, 2.7% of Republicans have returned their ballots so far. So it doesn't seem like there's anything that's overly animating one side or the other, or independents. They're tracking alongside too. So I wonder why there's less, so far anyway, fewer people are returning the ballots. Anecdotally, it seems like some of my friends are saying they're still hashing it out who they want to vote for.
I wonder, the three-way gubernatorial race, which it's on a knife's edge in terms of the top two, right, Drazen and Kotek, that may have slightly depressed turnout.
And that was my talk with history professor and author Dr. Chris Nichols with The Ohio State University. Previously, he served as a professor at Oregon State University for 10 years. Finally, some encouraging news for small businesses and nonprofits still working to recover what they lost due to the pandemic. Bookkeeper Laura Ricksecker told business owners and nonprofit managers with the East Portland Chamber,
"Today, the majority of you with W-2 employees will qualify for up to $26,000 per employee in credit, even if you took a PPP loan."
She says that's because the rules have changed to allow more businesses that took PPP loans to also qualify for the ERC. Employee Retention Credit.
The ERC credit is the Employee Retention Credit, meant to reward businesses that continued to pay their W-2 employees during the pandemic.
As an example, a business with 15 employees could get a $250,000 credit, a check from the IRS that does not have to be paid back. Ricksecker explains why she's trying to get the word out to local businesses and nonprofits to not leave this money on the table, which could help local communities.
Because I'm tired of all the corporate entities and the larger business structures snapping up all the money that's ever offered. And we're the ones, the small and mid-sized businesses, that really took the hit during the pandemic. Businesses are leaving billions of dollars on the table.
She says many local business and nonprofit owners are not aware that the rules have changed and that they can now qualify for hundreds of thousands of dollars in Employee Retention Credit, or ERC, even if they got PPP loans for keeping people employed during the pandemic. Ricksecker explains why she's trying to get the word out to small businesses and nonprofits.
The ERC, the Employee Retention Credit, was part of this package, but very few people took advantage of the ERC, partly because you couldn't do both back in March of 2020. The IRS management anticipated that approximately 80% of small and medium-sized businesses, as well as tens of thousands of nonprofits, because nonprofits also qualify, were good candidates for taking the ERC. In March of April of 2021, the IRS issued several notices over these 2 months. The most important is that businesses that took the PPP are now eligible for the ERC. So now you can have done both. Our most recent change was November of 2021, the Infrastructure Investment and Jobs Act. It has now really loosened it up. They really want people to take advantage. And it's now estimated that 80% plus of small to mid-sized businesses will qualify for the credit. And when this money comes back to you as a form of a credit to your business, that flows right into your local economy, right here into Portland's economy. And boy, do we need it.
You've been listening to Speaking Freely with Annette Newell. Thanks so much for tuning in. If you have a topic you'd like to hear about on the show, please send me an email about it to annette.newell@alphamediausa.com. One more time, that's annette.newell@alphamediausa.com. Be sure to join us again next week and check out our Speaking Freely podcast online at kxl.com. Have a great week ahead.